this is Killer Crawl Space. This is episode 21. This episode is going to feature about Robert Bobby Joe Long. But he was born October 14th, 1953 in Canova, West Virginia. He would bounce back from Florida to West Virginia early in his life. His mother enjoyed Florida while his father enjoyed West Virginia. They would fight a lot, which led him to split a lot of times as well. One of his first injuries happened at a very young age. And it was said he fell from a swing and hit his head. It would knock him unconscious when he came to. He'd have a stick in his eye. But he would be enrolled into Canova Elementary School and would fail first grade. I'm assuming around this time in the late 50s, he'd be 6 or 7 years old, and he would experience his second head injury at a young age. He would be hit by a car when he was coming home from school, and it was snowing. Him and another little boy would dash out in front of a car, causing Bobby to get hit. It would throw him into a yard. He'd be taken to the hospital and have surgery that night. The incident would mess up his teeth, and he'd get made fun of over this. His mom tried to get them to put braces on him, but they would not until he turned about 12. When he was 10 years old, he'd have gone to two different schools in Florida and two in West Virginia. They'd end up staying in Florida for a while after that, and his mother and father would eventually get back together in later years and would settle in Canova, West Virginia, but that is for later. Back to his childhood, it was mentioned he felt his mom neglected him, and he felt alone. It would state he was jealous of the pet dog, and there was talk that the dog would be fed steak while Bobby would be fed like a burger, which a burger is not a bad thing to eat. That's a common food a lot of people eat. But he always felt he could never do right with his mother. There was at one point that he would have almost drowned while in Florida. He would remember it that his mom would almost let him die because she was checking out guys, but she always would say that wasn't the case, that he just got away from her, and next thing she knew, she heard a kid screaming from the water and realized it was Bobby. His mother would have a lot of boyfriends over. He didn't approve of a lot of the men she would have around. And they said that she got with one guy that he liked until that guy whooped him, and then he didn't like him anymore. But, basically, he was raised with, like, babysitters, from my understanding, like, other family members when they all shared, like, with, like, 12 people in one house. But they said that he would share a bed with his mother until he was 13 years old. And when she'd have a boyfriend over, that Bob would have to basically sleep on the couch that was still in the same room. But a lot of people would state he blamed his mother for his problems when he'd always get upset talking about her. Was this the reason he grew to hate women? It was mentioned he'd call women sluts when they wore revealing clothes. His mother would reveal clothes from my understanding. She would wear revealing clothes from my understanding because she'd work bars. Bobby would not approve of this outfit. So, as you could tell, it seems like he had mommy issues. But I did notice at times when researching Bobby that his mom and him would remember stuff differently than others that were around Bobby at a young age. Because, like I said, it seemed to kind of correlate with what Bobby said, but she would kind of remember it differently. You know, I don't know if that's just her just saying she was a perfect mother, you know, which not all parents are perfect. You know, I'm a parent, and I'm far from perfect, but yeah. At around the mid-60s, probably 65 or 66, he would meet the love of his life. From my understanding, it was them two versus the world. And it would upset his mom because she felt his girlfriend was taking him over and away from his own mother. They would do everything together. And there was talk that she even looked like his mother. In 1970 would be the first brush he'd have with the law. It'd be some buddies and him still in a car battery. The charges would be dropped, though, and in 1971, he would run from a cop. And they said he got probation without conviction on it, but one report was supposedly he stole another battery. But his future wife would say that it was because of that he was drag racing, and he happened, I guess, to be the one to stop, so the cop stopped him. So, I'm assuming between 71 and 72, so it'd be before he turned 18, since he was born in 53, it had to be at least 71. But there was a rumor of him raping a girl would come to surface, but they said it turned out to be a lie. It was stated he just gave her a ride home. The cops would still bring him in to fingerprint. He'd drop out of school after turning 18. But September 1971, he would join the army. Well, yeah, it would have to be 71 then with the rumor of raping the girl. His wife would be pregnant at the end of 1973, and they would marry January 25th, 1974. Around March 1974, an older gentleman would pull out in front of Bobby while he was riding his motorcycle. He would hit the car and fly over the top of it. I've heard 40 feet, I've heard 100 feet, and whatever, even 40 to 100, that's still bad. But he would land on his head. The wreck would almost kill him, and it would take him almost a year to fully get back to normal. He would be in the hospital for a little bit, I think like a month or so, maybe, or maybe a couple months, I think. But he'd still suffer from a slight limp, headaches, dizziness, and other things, you know, throughout the rest of his life. Which I'm assuming he's still, you know, now. But during his time in the hospital is when it seemed his sexual urges would increase. It had been reported he'd masturbate every day when the nurses would come and check on him. He'd also want his wife to perform sex on him while she visited. This third injury seemed to really bring out the sex fiend he would later become. Besides the increased sex urges, it was violent, unexpected temper tantrums over the slightest noise that most people would overlook. And some days he'd be fine, but other days he'd be crazy. Family would say you'd never know what you'd get from him on a day-to-day basis. A little more into a sex hunger after the accident, he would fantasize about any woman who he crossed paths with. He said his wife and him would have sex 2 to 3 times a week before the accident, and it would go to wanting it 2 to 4 times a day after the accident. And he would say he'd need to masturbate at least 5 times a day to get the relief he needed. And this is just say he had sex 2 times. That means he'd have to masturbate at least 5 times. That's 7 times, you know, during a day. Just to feel, you know, relieved. That's a lot. Hold on, let me continue going through my notes. Okay, in June 1974, their first child would be born. Bobby would still be recovering from his injuries and was out of the army and no job. There is speculation why he got kicked out of the army. One version, he said that it involved the teenage daughter of a homestead officer. He said it would be attempted rape, but he would pick her up 2 blocks from the base in his uniform with his shirt, with his army shirt on, I guess, and a cast on his leg. In another version, he would say he was able to convince the authority that the girl had willingly agreed on giving him oral sex. Whatever truly happened still left him being discharged. He would get a 40% disability rating due to the injuries he got from his wreck. I kind of wonder if this maybe been, well, no. Unless this was the rape that it was, you know, for, you know, he turned 18 around 18, but it possibly two different things. Well, 2 different times. But after he was released, he would jump from one job to the next. They would move from place to place, and they would eventually get a bigger house that they couldn't afford. In early 1975, she would become pregnant with their second child. Their second child would be born October 1975. And a few months later, he would leave them in Florida and travel back to Canova, West Virginia to stay with his parents for a few weeks. This was around the time that, I guess, his parents had got back together for good. And I'm assuming that would have been, like I said, for good. But he would say he left his family down in Florida to go up there to West Virginia to find a job. But he blamed his wreck for the work being too hard for him. In 1976, they would move around, and he'd still bounce from job to job for a while. But in 1977, he would settle on a career that could be stable. He enrolled in a community college in a 2-year course to get a degree in radiology. He would work part-time in radiology department at a hospital, and he would get his first full-time job as an x-ray technician, and it would still be too late to save the marriage. They would fight over money, him, you know, not holding a job for long, and she'd file a divorce in 1980. He would eventually lose his job and move to Tampa in late November 1980. He would claim it was over the divorce, but there was something else brewing in that area. The ad rapist was gaining a lot of attention in the headlines. But from everything I've read, he would go from job to job, just upsetting other co-workers that were women. He would usually come on to them and be basically an all-out creep to them. some girls he would date and not have too much of a problem. Well, they would not have too much of a problem with him. So it was just kind of weird. It just seemed like you can just click it on and off, which a lot of them, you know, can do stuff like that. And, you know, you'll get the nice version, then, you know, the people that they murdered, they get the psycho version. But there's one case, he'd moved back to West Virginia in late 1981. He would make phone calls that'd be traced back to him, and he ended up calling a 12-year-old girl. She was a daughter of a doctor from one of the places Bobby used to work at. He had called her and sent obscene letters to her containing various sexual photos. I'm not exactly sure when he went to California, but it would be sometime after traveling to West Virginia in late 1981. And from what I've read, he'd be back in Canova, West Virginia around the fall of 1982 and the spring of 1983. The California stay seemed to have been maybe roughly 6 months. But not to get too far ahead of myself, but I was reading a book. I think it was Ted Bundy, where he was hunting for the Green River Killer. But Bobby was actually questioned on that, you know, back then. But he would continuously try to get jobs while in West Virginia, but nothing came to be. But in mid-November 1982, he'd be arrested for destroying private property. The man had gotten an argument with his mother. Bobby would step in between them and take the man outside, where he would shove the man and rip off a side mirror on his vehicle. He would have to pay a fine, and in February 1982, he would get a job at the VA hospital. He would meet a woman there, and eventually they would move back to Florida for a short period of time to find a job. One thing to know is that it was stated that Bobby hated West Virginia with a passion, and at this time, when they returned to West Virginia, she would go back to the VA hospital while he would land a job at the Huntington Hospital in May of 1983. He would be fired in June. So, yeah, he really had problems keeping a job or stuff like that. But there were a lot of rumors about new employees. There's rumors about the new employee, so him, about where he would make female patients take off their robes because, according to him, it would get a good x-ray. And this was like getting x-rays on stuff that had nothing to do with them, you know, taking off their robe. But it does seem he left a good impression at the VA hospital because they would give him a letter of recommendation, and in turn that led him to move back to Florida, and he would land a job as an x-ray technician again. And he would last there for 10 months, and he would date this girl from, my understanding, August of 83 to August of 84, which that's more of a year. So, you could probably say anywhere from August to June of 84. And she would mention about all these pieces of jewelry he would give her. The weird thing is, they would discuss the women who were turning up missing. He would tell her that she'd be safe and not to talk to strangers because there are a lot of sick people out there. But in April 1984, it seems he tried to attack a lady. He would get her to pull over in a parking lot. And he acted like he was crazy about her car. You know, he'd ask about giving him a ride around the block because he'd probably never get a ride in one like that. From my understanding, it was a Jaguar. But she would basically say, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with him. You know, he seemed like a good guy. So she would drive him around the block. But eventually he'd pull out a gun on her, and she would violently jerk the wheel from side to side, and this would cause the car to flip over. Neither would be hurt, and he would take off once everybody stopped to try and help her. The cops would find him on foot, close to where he left his car in the one parking lot, and he would say he was the man from the wreck, and all he had asked was a little sex from her, and then she went crazy. He denied pulling a gun on her, and the gun was never found, but he was arrested and charged with aggravated assault. 3 months later, he would get 6 months probation, and court ordered him to pay money that would fix the lady's car. And he would find a job in June, and during that time in another hospital, he would last until the end of September. That pretty much sums up his way, way crazy job history, which I know some people probably worse than that, but as you can tell, like I said, he could never hold a job. But he would be arrested in November of 1984 for murder. His first victim, well, I'll read the victims list. I'll try to go into detail and stuff. But Peggy Long, she was 20. Her body was discovered May 13th, 1984. It's questioned if she was his second kill. And Michelle Sims, 22, Her body was found on May 27, 1984. She had been beaten, strangled, and her throat was cut. Elizabeth Laudenbach, 22, found June 24, 1984. Channel Williams, 18, found October 7th, 1984. She had been shot, and far as I've read, she was the only victim that had ever been shot. There was Karen Den's friend, 28, murdered October 13th, 1984, asphyxiation. Virginia Lee Johnson, she was 18, and a Kimberly Hopps, she was 22. Her mummified remains were found October 31st, 1984. And then there is Kim Swan, 21, strangled body was found on November 12th, 1984. Then Vicki Elliott, 21, she vanished in September of 1984, and her body would be found November 16th, 1984. And Artis Wick, 17, she was the last one found. They wondered if she was his first victim. Now, hopefully I got all those names right, but as you could tell, he ranged, the youngest being 17 all the way up to 28. But his killing method was mostly was binding, raping, and then killing his victims before he would dump them in different areas and using odd positions. Like, for example, he spread Peggy's legs far apart, and they said from her left foot to her right foot, it measured 5 feet and 2 inches apart. But 5 of them would be identified as prostitutes, 2 as exotic dancers, 1 was a factory worker, 1 was a student, and 1 had an unknown occupation. But the reason that he would get arrested for these murders was because he left one alive. Her name was Lisa McVeigh. She was 17 years old when Bobby would kidnap her from the street she was traveling from work to home. And I won't go into much detail about her life, but she endured, like, sexual abuse by... He wasn't her father. He was her guardian, basically. He was a double amputee, but he basically sexually abused her. So they kind of wonder if this... if that's what kind of helped her prepare for what Bobby put her through. Because, you know, he would kidnap her, sexually abuse her for 26 hours. And there's reason to believe, like I said, that what she experienced at home is the reason that kept her alive. Which, very possibility. But she would state he'd be nice, mean and nice to her during the 26 hours. He would bathe her and apologize all the times. Because he basically kept her tied up. He would blindfold her and stuff. Sometimes he'd take the blindfold off, but he'd turn the lights off. And he made her a sandwich and everything. But she would talk about his voice, that it was kind of girlish. And he would ask her about, you know, her personal life. She would lie about it, like where she worked at. She didn't mention the sexual abuse at home, but she would say she helped take care of her father, who was terminally ill. So he kind of got, like, on a personal level with her. But she would promise herself to remember everything she could about this so she could tell the police she made it out alive. When she made it out alive, that she could tell them everything. So he would eventually take her away and let her go. And she would remember the little details about his car, like his apartment of what she could see underneath the blindfold. And when he let her go, he'd tell her to describe himself differently to the police. She would make it home and report everything. And they were surprised how much she remembered. And there was talk they almost threw it out because they felt it was a lie. They were basically saying she was a teenager. She ran off with one of her boyfriends. And this was just the story that she made up to, you know, make it why she was gone for over a day. But she would have a clue on her. A microscopic red fiber that was found on some of the other victims. The murder victims. The red fiber came from his car. The police would take her around the area she remembered seeing, you know, from underneath the blindfold, and one of the cops kind of knew the area. So they'd be able to pinpoint the kind of car Bobby was driving because she had seen the word Magnum on the dashboard. Only the 78 and 79 models had it. And from my understanding, I think he actually picked this car up in West Virginia. I'm not sure whatever happened to it, but it's very possible he did get it here. But they would get the, because before he dropped her off, he stopped at an ATM, basically, and got money out. And they would get the bank transaction sheet back, and Bobby's name would be there around that time and the date that she said. and his name would also be on the list for the 78, 79 Dodge Magnum owners in that area. I think there's like 15 pages, and he was like on page 14. So two officers would pull him over and talk to him. He refused to let them search his car. He would let them take pictures of him and his car, though. And they would keep him under watch roughly 3 hours later until he was arrested. But the two police officers would check out the apartment area and notice it all fit like Lisa described. Lisa would be able to pick out Bobby in a photo lineup, and everything else came back in the car and bank transaction. So they knew they could at least arrest him for the kidnap of Lisa. And like I said, he would be arrested on November 16th, 1984, outside of a theater. From my understanding, like, he was in the, he was watching a movie, and he had, like, the two cops, I think in front, two in behind or something. Like, he had, like, four to five cops around him in the theater. And the next thing he knows, when he comes to the theater, basically all the police officers are just swarming him. But it's been said that Bobby would never really give a reason to why he let Lisa go. If he hadn't, you know, how many more victims would he have had? You know, he did kill Kim Swan after letting Lisa go. Because there was speculation that, you know, he was trying to get caught is why he let her go. But if he killed one person after that, he just thought he was possibly smarter than the actual cops. So, but Lisa's bravery would bring a stop to Bobby Joe Long's killings. And the best thing to describe her is a woman from what I've seen and read, and she's on, you know, they've interviewed her and stuff. She seems like a very strong, nice lady. You know, she's endured a lot. But, you know, she made a name out of herself. I think she has a daughter, if I'm not mistaken. And she's a police officer in that county. I think she kind of like goes to one of the middle schools and like watches over it. But, you know, she done, you know, she went through a lot, and she actually stopped him, you know, by, you know, he didn't, she made a connection with him, you know, and he said she was special and he just couldn't hurt her and all that. But, you know, he gave her nightmares, you know, to kidnap a 17-year-old girl like that just off the street. But he just kind of had it. He had an ego, like, bad. But if you remember earlier, I mentioned the ad rapist. Well, it turned out Bobby was the ad rapist as well. And I had read he raped at least 50 women. And I've heard the number up to be up to 100. I don't know if that's true, but just say at least 50. But I'll read a letter from Bobby where he talks about the whole setup he ran. I apologize for any language in it, but here it goes. How it worked was the standard process I used in about 30 to 40 of these things in three states. It was really foul-proof, and if I just stuck with it and not gone this cunt's way killing people, I'd still be out there. It was like a hunt, really. I would pick up certain ads in the local paper wherever I'd driven. I never worked in the county I lived in, and go to the classified ads and look for beds for sale or bedroom furniture for sale, because in order to see the bed or the furniture, you would get a good chance to check out the place and make sure it was just her or her and her very small kids and babies. This all started back in 75 or 76. I'm telling you, it was perfect. Never even came close to getting caught. For years, I was referred to in the Miami Herald as a classified ad rapist, but I worked Dade, Broward, Palm Beach too, and then moved up here and have hit Manatee, Pinellas, I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing these way wrong, and Orange counties. It worked in West Virginia, California, and Kentucky. It was so good, I should have never switched. So basically, I should never switch, you know, to murder. But anyway, it got to the point where I could scan the ads, and just by the way it worked, know the approximate age. Naturally, I wanted young ones. But sometimes the older ones would be good enough, and they usually had nicer jewelry and more expensive shit. Mostly, I did it for the thrill and the high. So I'd go wherever I targeted, get a local paper, scan the ads, write down 10 to 15 numbers, go to a payphone, and start calling. If they sounded real old, 50 or more, I'd just hang up. If they were older but sounded good, you can tell a lot about a woman on the phone by her voice and choice of words. I'd ask a lot of questions, get a little humor, see their reactions or laughs. You can really tell a whole lot about the way a woman laughs or doesn't laugh for that matter, and if they were worthwhile. I'd get to the address and make sure they're going to be there. I'd always hit the early morning, 9:30 to 10. Husband and kids gone for hours, and eventually I'd work up the routine to where I'd even, when the hubby was coming home, well, he would know where the hubby was coming home, by saying we really need this stuff fast. Let's say I like it, and it's what we're looking for. How soon would someone help me load it up? By their answer, either my husband gets home around 6, or, well, I'll be here all day. I knew pretty much what I was dealing with, so out of the 10 or 15 numbers, I'd have it narrowed down to 3 or 4. Usually one I'd put a star by for the best, first and best sounding one. It was usually right on the money. This was one of the 3 ways I used that was perfect. I'll tell you about the other some other time. I have read that he raped a girl in California as young as 12, and in a letter he would go in the detail of raping a 13-year-old girl. I'm not going to share that. Just think of the sickest thing and go from there. But most of the times it seems he would threaten them with a knife, tie them up at times, and he said he would usually make them do the work and talk dirty to him. Bobby would end up going on trial. They would reach a plea bargain for 8 of the murders and the abduction and rape of Lisa. He would plead guilty to all these crimes. He would receive 26 life sentences without the possibility of parole and 7 life sentences with the possibility of parole after 25 years. And he would get the death penalty for the murder of Michelle Sims. Now, I think it might have changed because he's had other trials and stuff too. Because when they were interviewing him, he basically said, I think I need an attorney. So that kind of threw out his whole confession. So, but he's still on death row in Florida today. I started writing him back in late 2013. I last heard from him in 2017. But I'll say he is an interesting guy. You know, he'll be 65 this year. But he's very, very perverted, like very. And he asked a lot of sexual type questions about my wife. And he basically asked about like any woman I knew, basically. And he was always talked about these women that wrote to him. And he liked women that round in their 40s because he said they were much funner. And, you know, they're more, he's only 20 years older than them, roughly. At the time, he would have been 60 when I first started talking to him, you know, going on 61. But one neat thing I found interesting was he knew Ted Bundy because they were in the same prison, you know, until Bundy was executed. But he used to play handball and volleyball with him on the yard. And he said he was one of the few he could actually hold a decent, intelligent conversation with. And he would talk about the Bundy ghost in prison that's reported. And he said it was all made up from somebody in from inside the prison, like I guess one of the guards. But from my understanding, the book with the Hunt for the Green River Killer, Bundy was excited when new people like that came in the prison, so that's kind of one reason he went out to find Bobby, you know, because he could relive his murders, from my understanding. But we talked a little bit about West Virginia. He said he would cheer for Marshall and WVU unless they were playing a Miami team, because he liked the Miami sport teams. Like I said, he did hate the state. He said the only thing he enjoyed about it was Dreamland Pool. And he asked, you know, if that was still around. And the crazy thing is, his mom still lives here. You know, she's in her 80s. I actually found her house, you know, I think 2 years ago, roughly. And, I had another interesting thing happen to me. I do security. Well, I'm a supervisor. But I'm a security guard, though. And I signed in a guy years ago that came into the place I work at. And, like, I literally thought, like, it looked like Bobby Joe. Like, Bobby Joe Long. It literally looked like a young version of him. And I remember him saying he had a son. So I dug through letters and turned out the names matched. But I would eventually, you know, research a little bit more into it. I'd actually see a son on a TV show that they'd done on, you know, Bobby, and turned out it was not his son. But like I said, it was still freaky though, because he did look like him though. It was, and like I said, just with the names and everything matching, like I really thought that he came in the place I worked at. But I will believe this. Sorry if you heard my cats flipping out on each other. But I believe this will be the episode that, well, this will wrap up the episode about Bobby Joe Long. Thank you for tuning in. If you want, like I said, you can like my Facebook page, Killer Cross Space. You can now join the group. If you could rate me on iTunes or anything, sharing the podcast around. See, I'm on Patreon, all that, if you'd like to help support the podcast. But thank you for tuning in.
All the victims, all of them, you know, and you're talking about a lot of them, a lot of lives just gone right down the tubes because of me, you know, in one way or another. And it's not a good feeling. It's not a pleasant feeling. I'm not proud of anything I've done. And the worst thing is, I don't understand why.